There's also a book that I found there that I want to start with, who will call Who Will Listen to Me? It's Prayer Thoughts for High School Girls. Although, when I read it, and there's a couple in here that I want to read to you. So my frustrated poet will get out. There are things I can't talk about, odd things, some of them dumb, some of them disgusting, some of them just random, unexpected, and questions. Who can I ask? Sometimes I can't talk about things I've done. My parents won't understand, or they worry, or they think I'm crazy. And I'm not sure if I can tell some of my friends either. They might laugh at my ideas, and I'm not always proud of what I think or do. So what do, Lord? I suppose I can keep some thoughts to myself. Nobody tells everyone everything. I can discuss some things with my friends. It seems like when I dare to trust people to talk to them, it turns out they feel and think and act like I do. I'm not unique or crazy or weird. And I can tell you the rest and things I don't tell anyone else. Jesus knows that people have all sorts of experiences and thoughts. I can tell you, you'll understand. Sex isn't simple. There are moments when my body and how it feels surprises me. I'm at a new door. I can tell that my emotions and my body pulses are powerful. It scares me to have such strong feelings. I like it, but I have to do some careful thinking. Sex isn't simple. Sex needs guidelines. Babies aren't just cute. They need responsible parents. And I'm not ready to be a parent yet. And my body is capable of creating a child. My strong feelings struggle to overpower my sense of responsibility. Help me keep it straight. Help me be rational about future consequences. I'm glad I feel this way, so loving. Help me take care of myself and those I love in a responsible way. Again, the book you can get at the bookstore. My name is Christine George. I know I was talking to some of you yesterday afternoon. And I work for an organization in Illinois called the Illinois Caucus on Teenage Pregnancy, which is an advocacy and education organization. And that experience of working there for now over a year has really opened my eyes to a lot of questions about teen sexuality and about how responsible or irresponsible we adults in society have been in terms of dealing with this subject. Now, why are we talking about this? Why is this something that, you know, I work in public policy, and why is it that when I work in public policy, I'm talking about sexuality in teens? Isn't this something which is a private matter, which belongs in the home, perhaps in the church, in a youth group? But is this something that should be a matter of public policy? Well, I want to say that it is. First of all, and why? Well, teens need to know. Part of our responsibility as adults to the young is to give them guidance so they can become adults, so they can learn skills, decision-making skills, that they can have knowledge so they can make decisions. One of the things that's happening in the teenage years is that their bodies are going through tremendous changes. And they're not just physical changes, they're emotional and psychological changes. And they need to understand what those changes are. They need to have some explanation of those changes. You know, I was thinking of my own experiences with my mother, in which she never talked to me about sex or sexuality at all. Except I remember when, I can remember this vividly, I was sitting at our kitchen table and she came into the room sort of surreptitiously. I mean, it was suddenly like she was looking out of both corners as if someone could catch her, and said, "Here, read this," and then walked out of the room. You know? And it was this little pamphlet on menstruation that Modest, I think that there was, put out. And that was my only knowledge until I was a junior in high school and we had a film in gym class. This is a very progressive high school. It's Oak Park River Forest. It's supposed to be one of the top 10 high schools in the country. Later I found out that my mother and my cousins and my aunts that were older than me never had any inkling what was going on. You know, the classic story of you go to school and suddenly you start menstruating and think you're dying, that you're hemorrhaging and something. I mean, we all know those kinds of stories. And I'm sure that in terms of males and sexuality, you have similar stories, not quite maybe as dramatic in that way, but in other ways. What is appropriate and what is inappropriate as your body goes through changes and you have different thoughts and stuff like that. So one reason to talk about teens and sexuality in a public way, or to say that there has to be, you have to have a clear view of what to do about it, is because it's an obligation. The teens are going through this, the youth are going through this. And unless we want to repeat the errors of our parents or our grandparents, we need to figure out how to communicate and how to discuss the issue. And it's real hard to communicate. I want to say this. I have friends who were sure they were going to communicate real clearly. And even some of them who brought all the right preschool books, you know, talking about body parts. And now it's like, because one of the things that happens is there's a whole bunch of communication issues that occur between teens and their parents. There's a lot of rebellion. There's a lot of hostility. There's a lot of just natural things that occur. It seems, doesn't seem natural at the time. You can look back in hindsight at it. So it's a very difficult time. So it's not something that's easy to do. And so you really have to think and plan from a long time how to do it and work it out. So that's number one. Second part of why we need to talk about it is not only is it happening right now to teens, but again, the obligation that this is preparation for adulthood. Again, I think of a lot of mistakes I made by not having discussions earlier on and not having some sense of, you know, as that poem said, I thought that, you know, that I'm not weird, that I'm not unique, that other people are going through things to me, that there's certain skills that you can learn, there's certain formulas that you could do, especially in decision making and making appropriate choices for yourself. So that preparation for adulthood. And that is partially sexuality, but it's broader like that. It's the whole gamut of how you choose a career, how you choose your lifestyle. A lot of the, for example, prevention programs in terms of drug abuse, substance abuse in general, all those kinds of things really are together. You need to learn life skills. And hopefully that the family and the community can impart this, but also the schools, I would say, have an obligation to impart it. So that's the second reason. Now, and as part of that, or as part of the second reason, these are one of the areas of decision making that youth are going to confront. And they're going to experiment. So the hiding under the sand and thinking it's not going to happen, it is happening. It's just a given that there is a context and people are making decisions, youth are making decisions all the time. And as I said, it's in a time for experimentation. So that a lot of times thinking it isn't going to happen and there aren't questions that are going to come up in minds is, again, being the ostrich. The last reason we have to deal with this, well, those other reasons, if you don't, I think that we have a responsibility as adults to empower youth with knowledge and with skills to be able to cope with their lives. But even if you didn't, for some reason, think of this, sadly, there are two other reasons. Which is the question of prevention. Because not only is premature sexual intimacy potentially damaging emotionally, it doesn't necessarily have to be, but it sometimes can be. You can be bruised. You're being very intimate and open. And if you do that prematurely when you don't have the maturity to handle it, these are explosive emotions, explosive times. So you can be emotionally hurt by this. That's a reason to talk to youth. But there's another reason, and one of the reasons is teenage pregnancy, premature pregnancy, and the other is sexually transmitted diseases. Now in this, I'm not gonna go through, in this facts at a glance that I passed out, I just wanna make you aware of some of the information. On the back of it is a table which is a number of births in 1985 to mothers under 20, and it goes by state. So if you could take the time like now or later and you could look at what's happening in your state. And then on page, and then going backwards again, you know, on table two, there's some comparisons between now and 1970, okay? And what's interesting about those comparisons, and we can talk about it later, I'm not gonna spend a lot of time now, is that the percentages of teenage births have gone down, but the number of
teenagers from 1970 to 1985 who aren't married and give birth has increased dramatically. So that's one of the facts that goes on. And also, the last one, table 3, birth to teenage mothers, has the 108 largest U.S. cities. So for many of you, you can at least, if not get your other community, get your own community, get a community close to you to, again, just give you the sense of what the statistics are. Now, teenage pregnancy is actually on the decrease in this country from, we'll say, the 1950s. But that's the good news. But the bad news is we, again, as in many other statistics, do far worse than all the other Western industrialized countries. 4 out of every 10 girls become pregnant before they turn 20, and 1 in 10 become pregnant every year. Although the teen rate has barely declined during the past 9 years, the number of births have fallen due to a smaller number of teens. So the rate's the same. But 500,000 teens gave birth last year, and which is, now some of those are older teens, because right, teen is 19 and younger. And I think one of the things is the question of older and younger teens, because it's much more damaging to younger teens. 10,220 of those were under 15 years of age. And that's the figure, I mean, that really sticks out in my mind. And also why teens' marital births have fallen 57%, the non-marital births have increased by 40%. So the number of teen births outside of marriage have doubled. And of all the births to teens, 78% are the first births. However, 22% represents second births. In other words, this is the second birth that teen has had. 20% of those are white, and 27% of those are black. So that's one reason that you need to talk about teens, and that we have to have some sort of policy about teens and sexuality. The second reason is sexually transmitted diseases. Now, AIDS, which can have an incubation period of 5 to 7 years or more, I mean, every year they're finding that out, they're not real positive about that, is a leading killer among young men and women in their 20s in New York City. It has increased 52% overall in 1986, and among heterosexuals, it's increased 73%. Now, there are an estimated 2 million cases of gonorrhea and 3 million cases of chlamydia each year, which really spans all age groups. I don't have the individual statistics for teens, but what is true with teens is because they lack the knowledge and also access to important issues. In other words, if they have a problem, they often can't access the doctor, or they can't access, they're either scared, or they just can't physically access it, they don't know how to get there, it's not that available to them. And so what that means is they have a tendency to be treated later, not to be diagnosed, because they don't recognize that they don't have the knowledge, and then to be treated later. And so what's happening is a disturbing increase, and it's now one of the leading causes of sterility in young people. So that's another reason to be concerned. Now, what can be done and what should be done? I always look at Scandinavia and the Netherlands, Northern Europe, because their statistics are so different. They're not that different from us as people, right? I mean, many of you in this room, for instance, are Scandinavians and Germans. And yet, the statistics are very different in their culture. And why is that? I think the main reason is that they do not have a confused national policy. That their society, Sweden, for example, has a clear policy on the issue of sexuality in teens. And they, all the way down the line, know what their position is. And they have, it's something that is a comprehensive education program in the schools, K through 12. There is access to community organizations, and there's support in the family for knowledge. But I'm just basically talking about the public sphere, because that's the one that obviously the government has some power over. They have a lot of access to contraceptives and to health care in general for youth. It's a very easy thing for youth to get health care. And thirdly, they have these integrated programs. Now, interestingly, I want to say this. Some people will think when I tell you there is less teen pregnancy in Sweden, you will say, well, that's because they have a lot more accessible and liberal abortion policy. You know, some people, and that's the reason for it. However, that is not the case, because I'm not, when I'm comparing rates and I say that they have better rates, I'm not talking about birth rates, although they have better birth rates than us, but they have better pregnancy rates in general. In other words, less girls get pregnant, less girls either choose to have the child, and less girls have abortions. So both of those rates are lower than the rates in this country. We, on the other hand, have a real dual confused message. On one hand, everything in this country, not everything, but there is rampant sexual innuendos on television, in advertising, in music. I mean, it is basically everywhere. In fact, it is one of the main things of Madison Avenue to use sex to sell products. You feel good about yourself if you're attractive, if you're sexually available. This is an image which goes around. And that is something that is a reality. Yet at the same time, sex is something that is not supposed to be talked about and is not supposed to exist in terms of public policy. And so there is no way for someone to get an informed view of what's going on as a child in terms of sex. If basically what happens is unless you or the church or your schools are talking about in an accessible communicative way about sex and sexuality, and then you can accept where people are going to get information on sex is through peers, is through TV, is through movies, is through our culture, in other words. Now, it's real interesting also that 85% of American parents want to have sex education in their schools, which I think is a pretty high statistic. I mean, usually when you get 70% of the American people to agree on something, that's pretty high. And this is, you know, 85%. Yet, if you look at the states, the number of states that have comprehensive required sex education in the schools, the number of cities that have them, I mean, is a drop in the bucket. It's starting to change a little because of the fear of AIDS, but it is still a drop in the bucket. And that's because that there is, I believe, a mistaken belief by a group of people, a lot of, but basically thinks that sex education equals sexual promiscuity. That they think if you teach about it, if you acknowledge that it exists, and then in fact what you're saying is you're giving permission for people to do what you might think is inappropriate behavior. You know, they think if you don't talk about homosexuality, then there isn't any homosexuality. If you don't talk about contraceptives, then no one is going to use contraceptives. Well, as a matter of fact, again, statistics show, at least the studies have done, that this isn't true. That in fact, that on one hand, sex education doesn't have that much of an effect. I mean, it isn't a panacea, by the way, in terms of the issue. In other words, that if you take a group of young people in terms of when they're going to initiate sex, their first sexual experience, it's not going to change by if they've had sex education in schools. What's going to change is whether they're knowledgeable about it and they have protected sex. You know, but that's the only difference. Okay? It's not going to influence them. What's going to influence them is our peers, family culture, those kinds of issues. That's what's going to influence them, but not knowledge. Knowledge is, in terms of sex education, is not going to influence them. In fact, there is some, this is a very small study, there is some indication that actually knowledge might retard initiation of sex. And there's been two studies. One of them is in Sweden. Sweden decided to liberalize its abortion laws and make them even more accessible to youth. And that they were going to pass out contraceptives in the schools and make that very, accessible to youth. And there was a national debate on this question because some people were worried that was giving permission, and what was that saying in terms of, you know, what the state was doing. And so what they decided is that they were going to do that, but at the same time that they were going to increase in terms in the community and in the schools information about sex. They were going to start at an earlier age, they were going to discuss decision making, and they were going to discuss maturity. And what happened from that is that the rate of abortions went down. That there was some decrease in starting sex, but more importantly, more youth use contraceptives. So that was the effect of making something more accessible. Actually, it was used less, although, you know, appropriately. The next program that has been studied a lot was in Baltimore. And what occurred in Baltimore is that they had a school that basically had, you know, 6 weeks in PE, you know, usually in your first or second year of high school, a little talking in sixth grade, and that was all. It was the standard program that existed in the public schools in Baltimore at that time. And then they had another program which had this very aggressive, very, very explicit program on sex education, which dealt with family planning and decision making, dealt with life choices, gave a lot of information about contraceptives, and also had a school-based clinic that was accessible to the youth in which contraceptives were passed out. What we found out in that program is that among young women, the first time of having sex was 6 months later. In other words, instead of being like at 16 years at 10 months, it became at 16 years at 4 months. Okay? And the other thing is that the other way around, but you know what I'm trying to say. This is why I don't like numbers. And the other thing was that when women had sex for the first time, the number of them who used contraceptives increased. Okay, so it had both of those effects at the same time. There obviously haven't been a lot of studies because there aren't a lot of programs. And one of the things that is very important to realize is nothing works by itself. It has to be a comprehensive approach. Really, the community, the parents, and the schools have to be working together. You know, to give information and not to have access and community services doesn't make sense. To have community services and not to have permission and work with the parents doesn't make sense. To not have the accurate information doesn't make sense. I mean, you need all of it together to make sense on the picture. Now, what would public policy, in my humble opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people who have looked at this for a while, what would be good? What would really work? One thing is you have to have any prevention program K through 12. You cannot start talking about sexuality and life decision making in the 10th grade. Now, obviously, it has to be age appropriate. But the basic idea is that just as many things should be taught in the schools and should be taught in other areas and communication between parents and youth, it should start early and what's appropriate at the different ages. And there's been a lot of really good curriculums. I can give you some information about where to get a hold of them, or very good guidebooks and discussions that talk about what's appropriate at different ages. But it's important that it start early. In fact, most people, it's very interesting what happens. Because during the teenage years, there's a lot of rebellion going on, number one. And number two is, as we know, you're invincible, right? Sure, there's AIDS. And sure that you can die from AIDS. And sure you can get pregnant. But it's not going to happen to me because I'm invincible. You know, and so what they found out, actually, some of the best places to talk about prevention and to talk about how different behavior and the consequences of that behavior, both the short-term and long-term, is younger. Basically, to talk about it in middle school. Okay? And one of the places they've worked on stuff with this is the question of smoking. And they found out that if you can talk to young people at 10, 11, and 12, about how nasty a habit smoking is, you know, and how it is bad for the health and a whole bunch of things, it is more likely to catch on. If you haven't introduced the subject to later on, it isn't as effective to introduce a subject during one's rebellion ages when, you know, people are telling you things and you think they're telling you to tell them to you, you know, and for no other purpose. And it gets mixed up with a lot of other feelings that are going on. Another important thing that I've been emphasizing is that a program has to have access. You have to work with community groups, with healthcare clinics, in order to make sure that youth have confidential access to healthcare, that they can feel comfortable going to a nurse and going to a doctor and having that kind of access. And if that doesn't exist, you know, it's good that they have the knowledge, but the access is a key part of that. And it's important in public policy that youth, again, have access to all the things that are legally available to them. I think they need to have access to contraceptives, they need to have access to health care, need to have access to abortion facilities, know that it exists. My position is that that's something that the public policy has to give to the youth. In terms of their choosing what to need, that's something that's a decision that they make and they make with their families, but the access has to be there. It's key. Finally, another part of this is sex education. Talking about sexuality doesn't make sense by itself. It has to be part of the context. Really, I like the term family life education. I like it and I don't like it. I like it because I happen to believe that that when we're talking about sexuality, it's part of one life decision. There's a lot of life decisions to make. It's part of growing up, deciding what you want to do now, what your future is, what your choices are. So it's appropriate to do it within a broader curriculum, within a broader scope of looking at life. You know, you shouldn't just have a course on plumbing, you know, and that's sometimes how it's looked at, without putting it in any kind of context of where people are going and where they've come from and what their values are and stuff like that. At the same time, some people, you know, I'll say sex education, I'll say family life because it's less controversial, you know, and so when I say family life, I don't say to be a watered down way of talking about things, but a comprehensive that puts everything in its place. The other thing which I think is really important, I'm going to get back to family life in a minute, is I think peers are important. Youth talk to other youth. This is where they get knowledge. And the question of making sure that there is peer counseling, that there's peer discussion, that there's trust among peers in terms of communication is key. All the good programs that I've seen give youth a lot of power in those programs to develop leadership skills, to communicate with other youth, to learn how important confidentiality is, and they're the ones that work the best. And any program, whether you're deciding for your church to design a program or in your public, in your community to design a program, you know, we're talking about youth, you should be involved in that. That is definitely key. Finally, one other issue, which I don't have a lot of statistics on, is when we talk about sexuality in youth and we talk about the consequences, we have a tendency to talk about women rather than men. I mean, and some of that is for an obvious reason that women get pregnant and men don't. But if we have a view of life which shows people are equally responsible, we need to develop programs of equal responsibility. And there is just the beginning of doing that. There are the beginning of developing those kind of programs and talking about that kind of responsibility and that kind of life choices, decisions. And that's real hard because there is a lot of peer pressure on young men to show how manly they are and to prove something in terms of sexuality and to think of it in an irresponsible manner. There is a lot of pressure and turning that around and defining maturity and defining manhood in a new way in the community as a whole. It might be true in your church you define manhood in a more narrow way, but in the community as a whole, that is not true. That is not how manhood is defined. And that is, I think, a real battle and a real way. And I think a lot of programs that have existed have been weakened by the fact that they focus on women. I mean, I think they should focus on women a lot. I think that young women need all the support that they can have. But I think that we have to broaden the program to make sure that there are also appropriate young men programs. In Illinois, there's some really good peer programs going on, and I hope they'll, if they're not in your community, they will spread to your community. Finally, when I was saying I want to go back to family life for a minute, I think the whole issue, you know, having talked about sexuality, teen sexuality, I don't think sexuality is the issue, actually. I think the issue is self-esteem. And I think that if you look at all the problems and you look at all the issues and questions of self-esteem, you know, whether you think for if you respect yourself and have self-esteem, then as a young woman, for example, you are going to decide you're going to define what's going on. You're not going to do something because everybody's doing it, or because this is the only way you can show your love, or you're not going to have a child because this is the only person that's going to love you, you know, or the only way that you can show your self-worth, which is, you know, but you are going to have a view of yourself that's going to move beyond that. So whether it's to say no or to set limits in terms of protection, to see that you have a goal in life. I've always been interested, and I've always thought that a lot of women who, young women who have a strong sense of career, very active in athletics and stuff like that, usually are less endangered of becoming pregnant because they have a strong self-image. And I think that that is real key. In fact, if you look at indicators of teen sexuality, who is going to be someone who is going to be, well, just say who's going to become pregnant. Let's just take that because that's an area. Now, you might think someone coming from a church-going family, right, they're less likely to become pregnant than someone who is from a family that isn't church-going. That isn't true. At least none of the statistics so far have proven that out. That isn't, it might be for a certain individual, it might be something that strengthens them, but as a whole, if you put the two clumps together, that is not something which shows any differences. The differences are the issue of low academic skills. Something with lower academic skills is more likely to become pregnant than someone with higher academic skills. They're usually two different things. Okay? Yeah. There's three things that happen. There's the question of who becomes sexually active. That's a lot harder question to answer. I mean, it is a tendency in this country, basically, by the time a young woman has reached 20, by those earlier statistics I gave you, and some that you'll see in the Center of Population Options sheet, that youth will have experimented and become sexually active. I mean, what that means, you know, you could have one experience of sexually active or 10. They don't distinguish in the statistics. But the question of if you use protection, the question of if when you have a when you're pregnant, you decide to carry the child to term, or you decide to have abortion, or you decide or to adopt out. Those questions become ones of the stuff I'm talking about now. Okay? I don't have an answer to the first question. I can tell you the second one, which is contraceptives, and in terms of if you use or don't use contraceptives, and I can tell you the other one.
You can wisely become sexually active, or you can allow
right.
to get pregnant.
Right.
To me, they're two different.
Right. Or you can, you know, I worked in an agency when I had young people calling me up at the time, and they says, you know, and they would say, well, I'm pregnant. They said, but I couldn't have gotten pregnant. This was my first time. You can't get pregnant your first time. Okay, that's a big one. Another one is that you can't be pregnant when you do it standing up. In Chicago, a rumor was going around if you took earwax and put it in the appropriate place, you wouldn't get pregnant. I'm just saying that there are a lot of misinformation out there, you know. Some stuff I had never heard, very creative stuff. But in terms of teenage pregnancy, at least, or being a premature parent, I like to call it. There's a program in Chicago called Parents Too Soon. It's lower academic skills, poverty, which is often tied in with lower academic skills, more likely to be dropout. In fact, what it is it's the same kids who are at risk for drug abuse and dropout. All of those things have a tendency to go together. A lot of it is low self-esteem, no sense of the future, which is a real problem. Now, what can we do about this? And then I want to leave some time for discussion. I just want to talk to you about three models that I've seen, or I've heard about, not seen. One is I've talked to you about already, which is schools. You know, I've described a lot. You know, to be K through 12, you have peer counselors. Should have access to contraception or to health services, all of that stuff. But I think the things that are key in there is that parents have to be included in the process. And they have to be included in the process for two reasons. One, it's not going to work. In other words, if you're trying to implement a policy and the parents are against the policy, it won't work. I mean, that's a nice practical political reason. But the second reason is you want to make sure that what every program is developed really includes, it is crafted in a way which is really appropriate to that community. And the only way to do that and for people to buy into the process is to include people. And so that any kind of process that's, like if you're a school administrator and you say, this is what I'm going to do and just impose it, has a tendency not to work unless you're a dear, beloved administrator that everybody believes everything that you say. I mean, and there are some of those cases, but not very many. The second reason is, I think, you know, parents, you know, remember I said that 85% of the parents who thought sex education should be in the schools, a lot of those parents felt that they were uncomfortable or didn't have the knowledge to have that kind of communication with their kids. And so I think that any part of a program that is in the schools, and one of the responsibility for the schools, is to also have programs for the parents. You know, in which the same knowledge that's being imparted to the children is imparted to the parents, but also things in parenting and communication skills. You know, I was talking with someone, and I'm not sure you're here now, but we're talking about adoption, and they were saying how they had talked to someone who had just adopted a couple children, and the problems that they had to go through in terms of the bureaucracy and the checks and stuff like that. And they said, well, if natural parents had to go through that, it would be a lot different situation. And it's true, you know, just because you have a child, no matter what age you have that child, you haven't just learned parenting skills. It isn't suddenly, you know, you wake up not only having the child, but suddenly your brain cells are filled with all this knowledge about parenting. You know, and I really think that that's a problem, that the school which is there, which you pay tax money for, isn't also used as that kind of resource to give that kind of knowledge. So that's very important. But at the same time, I want to say this, why I think that the community and the parents really need to be involved and it has to be appropriate to the community. I also want to point, I think it's important that you have a gutsy program that really is honest and teaches about all the issues and all the choices. That it really needs to be, or else, you know, the kids are going to know it's not real. You know, if you say things, I mean, there's a reality out there, and if you're not talking about the reality that they see through their friends and they see on television and that are going on in their lives, if they're having questions and you're not addressing them, and then they're going to know that curriculum doesn't mean anything. And they're not going to listen. It's not going to be effective, so why waste the money in putting it in? I think it's very key for the church to be involved. And I'm using the church here, partially because we're here, but also because it's one of the strongest community organizations that exists. And there is really a role for the church, both, again, it's a tremendous resource for the parents, to educate parents. It is also a place to, you have your sets of values and your sense of what's right and what's wrong, and in order to help parents communicate that. The schools can't do that. The schools can say, these are the choices, here is how to make choices. But in terms of what the moral specific choices are, that really has to come from the parents and the church. And it's important that the church serves this role. There's a very good program called the Octopus Program in Illinois. And if anyone wants to come up afterwards, I'll give you information, which was a program put on by a professor at University of Illinois at Carbondale in Southern Illinois. And it is a sex education program for parents and then for youth, but through the church, which is very good in terms about life decisions and choices. I think that's why it's Octopus, supposed to be all these different arms of choices out there. So that another model is a model which is done in New York City by this guy Michael Carrera. And I just want to talk to you about this because it leads to my point about self-esteem. What Professor Carrera has done is that he takes a group of kids who often who are considered at risk, you know, who come from families that perhaps their older brothers and sisters are already onto drugs or are teen parents or they've dropped out of school. and situations like that. And he develops a whole program, which this is part of, but it includes them opening their own checking account and learning how to deal with money and going to, and getting a lot of tutoring and getting after-school jobs and having a lot of intensive peer discussions. And the information that comes out of those programs is they have worked very, very well in terms of those kids not dropping out of school, not becoming premature parents, and going, you know, not succumbing to drugs. So that kind of community program, which is very intensive, therefore very often expensive, is really key. But I just want to point out, too, that as you know, it's something might be expensive in terms of your community doing something now, but it's a lot worse and a lot more expensive for the individual, but also for the whole community if you have to suffer with the consequences of not helping people grow up to really enjoy their adulthood, but have restrictions on their life before their life has really started on some levels. So I want to conclude by saying I think that the problem in doing this, one is we don't have public policy, and I think that that's important. We have to develop a consensus and develop that policy, that 85% of the parents really have to start speaking out and developing things. Secondly, privately, I think people have the responsibility, parents in particular, when you don't know how to communicate, learn how to communicate. I know that sounds, but it has to happen. There has to be communication skills developed, there has to be parenting developed, and you have to just do it. There's no other choice. My mother's choice was not a good choice. And it's something you have the power to change. And I think youth also have a responsibility in terms of developing peer programs. Don't wait for the adults to do it. Really don't. You know, in your schools, in your church, say this is a program that you want, and this is what you want from that program. And I think that that's a responsibility we all have to take. Thirdly, there's a lot of problems which are harder to solve. You know, the social problems I talked about, poverty. Someone who has low self-esteem because they know that there's no job out there for themselves. I don't know how to solve those problems. We have to realize they're interconnected together. Those are the larger, broader problems. But we have now some time that's left, and I'd like to really just open it to discussion. What do people think of what I said? What are the problems you see?
Christine, how do you feel about the Wisconsin model, public law?
Well, I'm mixed on it, to be honest with you. This is a decision in Wisconsin that if a teenager has a child, their parents, the new grandparents, are legally responsible and financially responsible.
Both sides.
On one hand, I don't see anything wrong with it. I mean, I think it's a good idea. Okay?
Is it working?
But no, that's the problem because you can't legislate responsibility. You know, I mean, I think it's something. You know, when I said, for example, I think young men and their families should be more responsible. That's really something that's going to happen through the church or through the community. You can't legislate it. What happens is that that the cost of getting the money is often prohibitive, so that's one thing. You know, the bureaucratic cost of getting the money. And secondly, if it's a poor family to begin with, it doesn't work out. You know what I mean? So if there's no money there, what are you saying? And often that there's a large, not all, but one-third of teenage parent pregnancies come in poor families, so it doesn't solve that situation. The other problem is like the federal law, I was talking about this yesterday, decided that you couldn't receive welfare. You had to live with the grandparents. You know, the two generations had to live together in order to receive welfare. And also that the grandparents' income would be taken into consideration for the young family to get welfare. And that's a real problem because often it would mean that even if the grandparents were willing to support and then they knew that they weren't getting any medical or anything support, they would kick the kids out of the home. So it wouldn't work that way. And also that a lot of children who end up being pregnant are from abusive families or the family dynamic isn't really good. And so it's not healthy for them to stay in that dynamic. I think in the best of all possible worlds, if it's a healthy dynamic, that's the best place for the child to stay. Get the support from the family, go back to school. You know, I mean, I'm not, but I'm saying in reality, You know, some of those babies are the products of incest, or the child has become promiscuous because of abusive relationships within the family, or it's just a dysfunctional family. So, you know, it's one of those things that sounds good on paper, and there was sort of a compromise in Wisconsin. I don't know if people realize that. What sort of politically happened is they wanted to pass more supportive programs to teen parents, and the right wing didn't want to pass them, so they compromised and put this whole thing together to do both. Questions, comments, discussion? Yeah.
Just want to say a little more when you're talking about some of the non-sexual approaches to the problem of teen pregnancy. There's been a study through a clinic at the University of Minnesota, along with low academic achievement, when non-participation in any extracurricular activities at school and not having a significant adult in that one person's life. The challenge given to us, the community organization I belong to, was we get very divided on sexual solutions. We cannot agree on what we just, as adults, have not agreed on any of those issues. But here are some non-sexual approaches
That's
to
right.
take to help.
I think that's really, if you ask me one thing, I would say self-esteem and worth. There's no question about that in my mind.
Can you establish self-esteem at the age of 16?
Well, you can establish self-esteem a lot better at the age of 5. Okay. You know, but the question, you know, I was reading something which is great. It says, it's never too late to have a good childhood. Mm-hmm. And I think that I really was taken with that. I think it's a lot harder at 16.
From all I'm reading, everybody... First 5 years are critical.
Right.
First 5 years are critical. And you get the feeling by the time they start a grade school, so much has been established. I have never heard anybody say by the time you hit high school that you can salvage much of it.
Yeah, you can, but it's a lot harder. I mean, David Carrera is giving an example, you know, the Michael Carrera, you know, saying the New York example, but it's very intensive. You have to, I mean, the community has to be willing to put a lot of resources and a lot of concern in the problem. There have been studies done of children in abusive situation, and the earlier you can get them out, the better it is. And it just takes a lot of support and a lot of therapy and a lot of love later on. And it's going to be harder. You're going to have a greater failure, whatever you want to call it, right? But that's just, I mean, that's why you can do, that's why, again, I think it's important to understand of starting as many supportive programs as young as possible. But I think whenever you can do it, you do it, what you can do. Well, I think the one thing I would I have a couple of different suggestions. I don't know if any of them work. No, I do. I mean, some of them do work. One is to if you can, really start the pattern of having a place of having non-judgmental communication, especially early on. So there's a habit that if the family can develop a safe place for discussion, that's really important. And really developing a sense of listening, and even if you want to freak out and be judgmental, not to, but talk. This is, you know, this is a future adult, in many ways an adult already. You know, when I think of myself at 13, I think of myself as I think of myself now in some ways. You know, and I remember conversations and what I was thinking at that time. And I really think it's important to have that kind, you know, as I said, if you have it early enough on and you can make it a non-judgmental kind of situation. I remember there's this woman, Billy Adams, this black woman who works in women's health, and she was talking, it was just a beautiful story, she was talking about her daughter and her daughter coming to her at age 12 and saying that she wanted to get contraceptives. And Billy was very worried about this, and so instead of saying no, she just sat down and had a long discussion with her. She said it went over 2 or 3 days saying, well, yes, why do you want to do it? Let's talk about it, and really had a long time, and then said, well, if you still want to do it, you can, and the child said, no, I don't want to do it. And then went on about 4 or 5 times till finally, and she said, the age of 17, in this case, you know, which was actually statistically late, I mean, you know, I mean, given all the statistics, that child said, yeah, I'm ready for it now, and the mother said, fine. And here's my suggestion about what would be a good form of contraception. But obviously that they had developed a relationship of safe places. And that was extremely important. Yeah. Yeah.
So many times I think all of us are afraid of the first reactions. And I have a friend who said she keeps telling her child, her son is 14 now, don't be afraid to talk to me. I'm going to stomp and scream and throw a tantrum for 20 minutes, but I'll calm down. So as long as you know, I'll probably do this. He's not afraid of it. And he knows it's going to happen. She's going to stomp and fume and scream, pull her out. But then she'll calm down and talk. And I think so many of us are afraid of that first reaction, mm-hmm. no matter who we talk to or how old we are.
You know, the other thing is what you were saying about an adult in life, and I just want to say this, like, my best friend, I'm godparent to her children, and her daughter is now 13, God, not 17. And what happened is that when 11, Diane says, I'm really having a problem communicating about this stuff, and I'd like you to start that relationship with her. And I think that's another thing. You know, and right now, you know, Jessamy and her mother cannot stand in the same room together without screaming at each other. I mean, they love each other, but it's just, you know, in 2 years they'll become a little saner again. But right now it's a very difficult time, but I have a very good relationship. And to really use friends and use older adults, older brothers and sisters in that way. You know, it's not all, we don't have to raise our children alone. We should raise them in a community. They can help raise us. I think we have to end. Thank you.